My name is Jody Kretzmann, and this is a forum that we're calling Living the Rainbow, Hopes and Dreams. And forums are places for discussion, not for lectures, so there will be no lectures. There will be a couple of introductory and hopefully invitational remarks by a distinguished panel that surrounds me up here. A word of background. As we sort of enter into these days of celebration of multicultural life and find ourselves with two kinds of moments, it seems to me, the moments that have been coming up again and again in teaching sessions, which call us into a really good, hard look at what is not a very pretty reality in the United States and globally about the way in which peoples of different backgrounds are living together these days. A sort of hard look at the way race and poverty overlap. A hard look at in fact, the growing inequality in our own society and globally. A hard look at the way in which the ever-escalating environmental crisis is impacting most notably on poor people and on people of color. Our teaching sessions call us into hard, difficult kinds of discussions that stretch us, I think, in ways that we need to be stretched. And at the same time, what we're up to in these rainbow days is, I think, experiencing some moments of real grace and real celebration. I felt it myself at times during the Vespers this evening, and I felt it in lots of other moments of conversation and of connection among people here, so that, and at least during these days, those moments of grace and celebration for me are sort of enough to keep me in the struggle. But those of us who work in the pursuit of social justice for at least a part of our vocation, and I think in lots of ways that includes everybody in this room, sometimes find ourselves in places where the hopelessness is overwhelming, where we don't know what to do next, where there are many, many more questions than answers, where the depth of the problem seems absolutely overwhelming. When we held a forum on Monday night, beginning to think about the upcoming challenges of the rainbow on the mountaintop, we held out two possibilities of different directions the discussion could go. One about struggles and problems, and one about opportunities and hopes. Guess which direction the conversation went? Almost all in the direction of struggles, in the direction of sharing the real difficulties of doing multicultural work, of working for social justice within a kind of rainbow milieu. I think that that's valuable. I think that that's invaluable. We absolutely have to share our stories of struggle with each other. But at the same time, we need to share our sources of hope. Or else, we are not going to be in this for the long haul. And I, for one, am interested in people taking kinds of agendas we're dealing with here into the rest of our lives together. If we're Christian people, I suppose one of the central texts that draws us into a room like this, into a place like Holden for these kinds of days, and we'll hear it again during the next week a number of times, is Galatians. But now that faith has come, we are no longer under a custodian. For in Christ Jesus, you are all sons and daughters of God through faith. For as many of you as are baptized into Christ have put on Christ, there is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither slave nor free, there is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. And if you are Christ's, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to the promise. Right. That's where we are. We're called to be woven together as one people. That's what the call is. Right. But, as Reverend Jackson put it, with all of our colors distinct, and a kind of tapestry woven together. And that's a struggle. People who catch that vision, catch that Galatians vision, it seems to me, catch it in a way that pulls them into some hard times in their lives. Right. So, there are some folks up here to help us begin the conversation about when we understand what the hard times are about, where does the hope come from? And that's the conversation we want to have tonight. You just say that, for me at least, the sources of hope are three, or of three kinds, I suppose, and then we'll ask others to join. I find hope in my faith. Galatians helps. Galatians helps me. Right? Secondly, I find faith in other people, family and community. I can't, this is not, I think one of Braswell's sessions earlier is, had to do with engagement not being a solitary thing. You're with this, you're in this with other folks. Family and community is a second source of faith. And I think that sometimes a third source of hope is that there are occasional successes. One actually accomplishes something small sometimes, right? So that the work itself, occasionally produces some reasons to be hopeful. Fred has been sharing some of that within the context of the Evangelical Lutheran Church. So for me, those three sources are enough present in my life to pull me into the next week. I want to hear from some other folks about possible sources of faith, and then open it up above hope, and then open it up to everybody else. Let's start with Janelle DeGrucci, who is here at Holden this summer, taking a break from struggles as they appear in South Africa. And certainly if any place on earth these days is a combination of both despair and hope and a constant tension, your country is. Where do you get it?
Okay, I've been in the States since November of last year, which means that I've missed out on some of the major events or happenings in the country. With the, in February, the unbanning of the ANC, African National Congress, and the South African Communist Party, the release of Mandela, beginning stages of talks about negotiations, and then just very recently the lifting of a state of emergency in the country except for the Natal province, and about a week ago the launch of the South African Communist Party in the country. So all these events are signs of hope, signs of movement in the country. For me, I think I come in a fortunate era of the struggle, being a white person. In the 70s, the main ideological force was one of black consciousness, which was a necessary step. The Soweto uprisings and of 76, etc., came out of the rise of black consciousness. Moving into the 80s, one moved into more a non-racial ideology, an ideology of non-racialism. And there were things like the launch of the United Democratic Front, which took for its leaders many of the people who were involved in the BC movement in the 70s. So kind of you see a movement, ideological shift into non-racialism. To where now the call by the United Democratic Front, the UDF, and the African National Congress is for a non-racial, democratic, non-sexist, unitary state, of one, where there's one person, one vote, and a single voter's role in the, as I say, unified non-racial country. And I guess it's to be part of that movement is for me participating in that in hope, struggling. It's moving towards something concrete. I've picked out three kind of things, quotes I'd like to read to you. The first is one which you may be familiar with. It's Mandela's, taken from Mandela's speech at the Rivonia trial in 1964, when he was sentenced to life. And it reads, "During my lifetime, I have dedicated myself to the struggle of the African people. I have fought against white domination, and I have fought against black domination. I have cherished the ideal of a democratic and free society in which all persons live together in harmony with equal opportunities. It is an ideal which I hope to live for and to achieve, but if needs be, it is an ideal for which I am prepared to die." And Mandela read this statement again on his release in his speech in Cape Town when he came from Polesmoor prison. I think that's an amazing statement coming from our leader. The second thing I'd like to read is an article in the Freedom Charter. With the Freedom Charter, I don't know if people are familiar with, was written, came out of the Congress of the People, it was called, in 1955 at a place called Kliptown. And it has a whole lot of clauses stating out kind of a policy. It's been seen as the African National Congress policy. It's a document that is used constantly as the guideline for future society in South Africa. And one of the clauses in it says, "South Africa belongs to all who live in it, black and white." And it also declares that, now this was a document from 1955 that's used constantly. The Freedom Charter also says that only a democratic state based on the will of all the people can secure to all their birthrights without distinction of color, race, sex, or belief. And the last thing I'd like to read is from the Kairos document. We've looked at the Kairos document a little bit at Holden this summer. It was written in 1985, it came out of the 85 uprisings. And it's really a challenge to the church, the Kairos, the moment of truth has come. And there's a section in the document which was drawn up by black and white theologians together and lay people. And it reads, sorry, maybe I should just explain a bit more. It critiques very strongly state theology of the state, but also church theology of the institutional church or the mainline churches. It criticizes them very strongly for not taking a stand against apartheid, not taking a strong enough stand. And it looks to kind of a liberatory theology. So that in that document, the section on hope reads, "There is hope. There is hope for all of us. But the road to that hope is going to be very hard and very painful. The conflict and the struggle will have to intensify in the months and years ahead, because there is no other way to remove the injustice and oppression. But God is with us. We can only learn to become instruments of God's peace, even unto death. We must participate in the cross of Christ if we are to have the hope of participating in Christ's resurrection." So, just to conclude, with a hope, one needs to have a commitment to work for change. You need to be doing something to live out your hope, to participate in the birth of a new society, despite the pain that must accompany it. And it's a rejection of rejection of cynical disregard for the future generations, and it's an expression of confidence in the God of justice and peace.
Mm-hmm. Janelle, thank you. I think it's a particularly important for all kinds of reasons reminder that you're giving us tonight, particularly for those of us in the United States, because we are probably at a moment in our own history where few people in the room feel themselves to be a part of a larger movement of history, right, that is sort of sweeping along in the direction of justice and peace. And we need to be reminded in the United States that there are places and lots of places on the globe where, in fact, that sweep is visible, and if you're inside it, it is a source of incredible energy and hope. glad that you've led us into that reminder. Some of us, I think a lot of us around the room who were involved in parts of the civil rights movement or parts of the peace movement, have experienced something like what it is you're sharing with us. From Tacoma, Augusta Braswell continues in the struggle for community and faith within congregation, within her own community. What keeps you doing that?
Well, I guess one of the things is from, I should say traditionally, maybe I should give you a little background on where I'm from. From Texas by way of, I should say from Tacoma by way of Texas. And actually, I was not really involved in a lot of the racial movements. And it was until I became an adult and realized a lot of the struggles that the blacks was really having. I had heard about it, but being sheltered as a child, I was not involved. But it was until I really got into the church and really, I was raised up very spiritually. I mean, we had our rules and regulation and being conformed into one structured church, that was it. And scripturally, you know, you learn all these scriptures, but yet you hear me quote some scriptures also, and it is from the King James Version, not from
the Revised Standard.
You have all the scriptures and you know all these nice words and the forms and everything, but it's really nothing. It means nothing to you. And until one really becomes born again, then I feel that you can see, you're enlightened all around, and you can see the struggles of everyone in the world, mm-hmm. in the society. Mm-hmm. And one of the scriptures there that it's in Romans, and it talks about, for whatsoever things was written for our learning, that we through patience and comfort of the scripture might have hope. But you can have the scriptures and yet not know the meaning and do not understand it nor the spirit, then it profits you nothing. You know, he also said, my people are destroyed because of the lack of knowledge. And most of us do not have the lack of knowledge, I should say, according to, I should say, what society really says or how they think that we should be unified. I know within my church, I look around and I see it's, my pastor is involved in a lot of community ministries. And one of the things my husband and I do, we have a class for dysfunctional couples. And to see couples come and want to be helped, it's an honor for me, because number one, usually a man will not want to come with his wife for help. I think a man has a little bit more, egotistical.
Yeah, egotistical.
Yes, sure. You know, about them, that they will not come because, you know, hey guys, you know it all, you know. And I feel that it's always the wife that's the one that's struggling. And when I can see couples come for help and want to be unified, want to be together in a society, want to be part of, then I'm willing to help. But then also I'm crying out, who wants to help me help those people? And I think this is what it's all about, you know, to see the poor with also within the church. And I was talking earlier to some people, and I had mentioned that I feel that there are so many people in the society today, and I know especially where, in the area where I live, that would not want to come in a setting as such. And also we have to realize that the more knowledge, the more responsibility. Mm-hmm. So you ask, do you really want more knowledge? Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people that I would love to bring in a commune as such, just to let them know that it's not just one way. And I think we get caught up many times in being conformed to a religious program, to a religious society, to just one community. And in fact, that's what I've seen within the world that I live, where we have the protocol thing. You know, if my church family was in a group as such, we would have pastor, we would have missionary, and we would have to honor those protocols being in the setting. But here, I don't know if you're rich or poor. You know, faces have no color. We're all the same in God's sight, and in my sight, as far as I'm concerned, we're all the same color. But how do we get the message across to others to let them know that we're all in one world, and God intends for us, he has no respect of person, I should say. And I'm just, you know, as so often I think about how the struggle on the cross for him was that he stood for our hope when he died. I mean, after all, Jesus could have been just like Peter. You know, he could have said, hey, I don't know the man. You know, I ran away and says, no, not me. But he chose to die for us, that we might have the hope. And just think, if he gave, or he looked out for just a little sparrow, what more would he do for his own people? And when he made us, he didn't make us just one color, or I should say just in one, what's the word?
One mold or one?
Well, he made us as one, I should say. He did not separate us in colors. And I think this is how we should look at it. In fact, this is how I look at it, as how would Jesus, if he would walk into this camp, what would he think? If he would walk into your church, what would he think? How would you treat him? If Jesus would walk into your home, how would you treat him? Or how would you act around him? And I think these are some of the questions that we should ask ourselves. How would we react if he was actually in the midst? And it goes back to what my husband says many times. What do we really believe in?
Man, as a pastor and a mother and a person living biracial family living in different parts of the city. How do you go at these questions?
Well, I have to go back a little bit, and because we didn't call it apartheid in Central Florida where I was growing up, but something like it was operational and is to some extent today. I grew up in the segregated South. My public schools were all white or all black. And my church was all white. But I think probably unintentionally, the youth wound up in an outreach ministry that put us face to face and hand to hand with young people in the migrant community in Central Florida who are our own age. We were in a hot cinder block, sandy, dusty summer program for the children of migrant workers. And we were participating as junior high students through the church with junior high students from the migrant camps in putting on this vacation recreation program for the younger children. And what started out, I think, as a very patronizing, you know, big brother, big sister, we're going to help these poor black folk, turned out to be something very different. Sometimes there's hope in the church, even when the church doesn't plan to be hopeful. It's one of the main reasons I believe in the work of the Holy Spirit. Because what happened at that migrant camp, besides a lot of sweating and a lot of laughter and a lot of fun, and a lot of fear to begin with on both sides, was that at 12 noon every day there was a dance. That's what closed down the camp each day. Well, I still haven't quite forgiven my parents for not letting me go to dancing classes like, you know, all the other kids. Because they thought dancing was something natural that you just learned how to do and picked up and didn't have to pay for. But being very self-conscious, I always stood on the side and criticized the people who were dancing. And I found myself in a very hot, dark corner of that cafeteria, watching, listening to music I had never heard before. Very loud music, very strong beat. I think it was Sly and Family Stone. And watching people get on the dance floor and do things that I knew that my body wouldn't do. And so I sort of stayed in the corner and thought I was safe. Until an 8-year-old girl approached me. And I wasn't too worried about that. I mean, she wasn't going to ask me to dance. Wrong. She asked me to dance, and she wouldn't take no for an answer. And that was a very strategic moment in my understanding of cross-cultural, cross-racial relations. Because it was the first time that I was face-to-face with someone who would not let me be excluded from the circle of love and joy. She was going to include me whether I wanted to be included or not. And that was very powerful. So the church, in a roundabout way, allowed me to meet in a way that was respectful of all of us. Some people from a different race, from different economic group, from a different culture, really. We were living 10 miles apart, but we were in very different worlds. So the church provided some hope in a roundabout way through this little girl. As an adult, I've seen an awful lot of change happen in my lifetime, my 37 years. And part of that is a change that happened in my family. I'm hopeful because there are parts of the family who still haven't really acknowledged my marriage. But the hope is that there are people who gave lip service to inclusiveness and your sort of colorblind images, who taught me to be that way because that's what they believed God wanted. And then were able, through some struggles of their own, to identify that they had a problem. Another source of hope for me is identifying my own racism. That's real hard. And also freeing. Because once you can name the dragon, as Roland talked about, there's a chance for it not having the same kind of power over you. For me, racism, white racism, is my assumption that I can walk into almost any room, almost anywhere, and be accepted just because of what I look like. I don't threaten too many people. And just allowing myself to take that for granted and not name it and not see it when it happens is part of my racism. And not appreciating that for you, or for you, or for you, or for any people of color, almost wherever they walk in, they can't take that for granted. Being able to somehow get a sense of that through my marriage and through being the mother of biracial children has been painful and hopeful. Because I think, again, once you can name that, there's some possibility for the community also being able to name that. But I think it has to happen both individually and collectively. I think the church has a real hard time naming that. We have a hard time seeing ourselves as racists. We don't want to talk about our own racism because we want to think of ourselves in the best possible light. We want to think that we would be open to whatever happened. I'm a United Methodist pastor, and in our denomination, at least in my annual conference, I'm in Northern Illinois, where some of our stronger churches are the Hispanic churches, the Black churches, the Korean churches. We probably have one of the most diverse districts on the north side of Chicago and north to the suburbs that there is anywhere in our denomination. And we're learning this from each other because we're having multiracial or transracial and transcultural appointments. Every local church is reminded by their district superintendent, who is the bishop's representative for various districts, once a year at least, that your next pastor could be Black, could be Asian, could be Hispanic, could be a woman. No. And none of those things are reasons why people can say no to the bishop. If that person fits the gifts, and if their gifts and graces fit the needs for ministry in a particular congregation, that's where they go. So we do have in our district about 30, no, in our conference about 39 cross-racial appointments. And I think only one of them is a white pastor to a predominantly black congregation. It's a Hispanic congregation, and that particular Anglo pastor is bilingual. So there's an Asian woman serving an Anglo parish. There is a black man serving a predominantly white parish, and on and on and on. Our people are being forced, because of the polity of our church, to experience the leadership and ministry of people of color. And I think that's been a real gift. It's not been without struggle for everybody. And some of the problems have to do with finding community.
Thank
you. But
there's
hope there.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. We've got three different stories here of the ways in which the church, almost in spite of itself, can provide an arena for hope. We've got a reminder, I think, that's awfully important from Leanne about the intimate relationship between light and darkness and between hope and struggle. And we've got examples of faith, community, and the work itself pulling us into hope. Let's gather some more. The floor is open, or the fireplace is open, or whatever it is one opens here. Where does the hope come from for you all? Anybody? Stories about it don't need to be abstract.
One of the hopes and dreams that I have, my name is Ted Hutchinson, and I live near Seattle. I work in Seattle. One of the hopes and dreams that I have is that when we come to a place like this and we call it Rainbow on the Mountaintop or any other conference or get-together where there's supposed to be a multitude of people of color, that we will really have that. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that we have to do is to take an extra step, to take an extra measure, to be very, as Fred said earlier, intentional. We have to go out and take folks by the hand and make them really believe that we really mean for them to come and be here. They have spent so many years, when I say they, I have folks that have in my job, I have several different colors. Sometimes I'm Asian, sometimes I'm Afro-American or black, or sometimes I'm Hispanic, sometimes I'm Indian. And I get most shook up when I find myself being white, but but this happens to me, so when I speak in a tone that we have to, I'm in my white mode, and I always seem to catch myself, it's surprising. The kind of job that I have causes that to happen, because I feel that in my job I represent all the people for the Lutheran Church, especially in Region 1 that I'm in. But to go on with my story, I think it's very, 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 and in African language they say things three times, that's to give it force and emphasis. So I think it's very, very, very important that we go out and tell people, I'm going to take you by the hand. I really want you to come. And if it doesn't succeed the first time, you do it again. And again, and again. Folks of color, of all the so-called, I just call ethnic group, to all part ethnic groups, you know what I'm talking about. Every day, like the pastor says, every day they have to do this. This confrontation is every day. You don't think about it, but it is every day that they have to risk and risk and risk and risk. We've got to do the same, folks. This is a risking time. The church is in a position, I feel, to really step out and help people get back to the basic job that they have had and sort of scooted up somewhere along the line of bringing people to Jesus Christ, bringing people to salvation.
Amen.
And so we've got to be the servant, be the hands and the eyes and the ears and all the sorts of things for the Holy Spirit. And just try it. You'll like it.
And my name is Marion Hutchinson. Mm-hmm. I go with him some of the time. And I'd like to add, I heard a statement way before I ever met Ted in a class on racism that the Air Force gives to all employees. And they said that attitudes do not change circumstances, but circumstances change attitudes. And for some reason that stuck with me. And if you put that through your brain and think about it, I can think of instances in our lives. I can remember back, I remember, Pastor, about having our marriage approved by my family and so on. And I tried to reason with them. I tried to, I tried all kinds of verbal communication to no avail. But you know what worked? We just went quietly about our own business and living our lives. And eventually, prayed, right. We learned a lot about that. And the circumstances changed their attitudes.
So, in fact, you were married changed their attitudes.
No. That really made things
That would be, it changed their attitude. Let's think of it as a before and after, if that's what you have in mind. A before and after. A before the marriage attitude, an after marriage attitude, and then we might call it a post attitude. That's what you might have in mind.
So it took a while.
Yeah.
It took a while, and my husband kept telling me that, but I was ready to get up on the bandwagon and preach to everyone about all this enlightenment that I had now. About how we are all such racist as white people. And one other statement that I heard quoted by a Methodist bishop was that we white people are all recovering racists. That's how he begins his talks on this. I am a recovering racist. And that I thought that was very mean.
It's a kind of disease that white people have, right? It's a lot like alcoholism or anything else. Others, sources of hope.
Well, you know, I was listening to the couple there and I was thinking, it does not necessarily have to be color, a mixture of color that's married, that would cause one to think or cause one to reject. I mean, take for instance a Catholic and a Pentecostal.
Oh?
You know, you say.
We don't
within our own little colony, the Catholics, the Pentecostal, we have our own little say-so about, no, that's not right. They shouldn't. But hey, if we're serving the same God, if that same God died for me, that died for him, why not? Thought I'll just throw it. My husband's a Catholic and I'm a Pentecostal.
But you both preach.
That's same message.
Daniel?
This is such an interesting question, Joey, because as I keep thinking about it and trying to look at what has given me hopes and fuels my dreams, it's kind of bittersweet a lot of times, because it's very much for me tied up also with the pain of finding myself estranged from my own culture, or particularly from many of the things I grew up with as a white person. And I have an experience in seminary. There are a lot of different, a lot of African Americans, a lot of Africans in my seminary, a lot of Koreans. And so there are a lot of different groups besides a lot of white folks as well. And the kind of creativity and just brilliant insights of whole different angles that I get from the different groups are really a tremendous gift. At the same time, though, they point out a lot of things that are very painful that I've been unaware of about my own racism, things like that. And just one example, the African Americans have been particularly helpful at pointing out racist imageries of light and darkness in our vocabulary and in the way we talk about things, where lightness gets, whiteness gets created as good and darkness and blackness as evil. It makes it virtually impossible for me now to sing out of the LBW. But if you read the hymns in the LBW, they are just pervaded with images of light and darkness as good and evil. And so I find myself becoming estranged from things that have been very important to me as well. So I find a lot of hope and excitement in learning about those things, but also it's bittersweet because it brings pain and estrangement as well.
I think that's right. When you take a good look at the need for inclusive language all across the board, it's really something. I might have just like to piggyback on what you say. No one, I think, is more hopeful than I am about what could be happening. But I have to simply say that the phenomenon of racism is not something that's limited just to white people against people of color. My background, I'm a Roman Catholic, and I happen also to be a secular Franciscan. You may not know what that means, but I do belong to a religious order that lives in the world and follows the rule of St. Francis. And yes, I am married to a Pentecostal. Had she been a Baptist, I might have been called a Bapcat, but I don't know what they would call it. Anyway, I grew up in a Jewish ghetto. Why my parents moved there, I'll never know. I grew up in a Jewish ghetto and walked 6 blocks across town in the Bronx to Brooklyn High School. And in that particular parish, the people who were the leaders of that parish, my pastor, and I won't forget that, Father Drew, he was Irish. So now if all of the principles and ideas about imprint and human development, Eric Erickson, some of the other social psychologists who tell us about how we're raised, if all that is true, then what you're looking at is a black Irish Roman Catholic who has had the experience of the Jewish ghetto. After I went into the military and discovered that there was a world outside of 169th Street in Washington Avenue in New York, after I went into the Air Force, I discovered that there was such a thing as a difference. My first encounter with that was changing trains in St. Louis, Missouri. I went to the back car first time. Never thought about that. So I lived sort of a sheltered life too. The point I want to make, though, is that what I discovered in myself is that I did not experience any reprogramming until after I gained some education and began to study and read and talk and inquire about different things. My first encounter at a black church was an AME church, and I was 30 years old. You can imagine the horror of my friend. You can imagine the horror when everybody started clapping me. Tambourines, and being an Irish Catholic, I was numb. I mean, you didn't even scratch. and Catholics are notorious for not singing. Only since Vatican II do we even attempt to sing. And everybody else sang, we didn't. In ours, we're using some of the old hokey hymns, whatever you want to talk about it. So. The point I want to make is I really had to go through a reprogram to understand my own blackness. What I am suspicious of, and I think I can admit this, but what I am suspicious of, unbeknownst to myself, I probably harbored in my own head, inadvertently, some racist ideas. Another thing that I have noticed among my own people, there is a crisis that we go through, and this is where the hope part comes in. The crises I could outline is four. One is the crises of identity. Once I find out that I really am black and get into my history, there's some anger that comes up because of all the stuff that's happened to my ancestors and to me. And what did I do with that? When I work through that anger, the next crisis then comes in at how then do I fit in? And there is an identity crisis. And for a long time, there was this, like, people changed their names, did a lot of funny things with their hair and all, and because they wanted to get away from the Western ideal. Then the third crisis after we pass through that is one that deals with how do I fit in and how do I relate to my newfound sisters and brothers who really are different than me, but more important, how do I relate to other blacks? It's interesting. See, just as we have Italians, French, Swedish people, Norwegian people, German people, although we all kind of got thrown in the same stew pot and came over fish spoon on slave boats, we really are different. I'm not the same as this guy back here. He may be from a different origin altogether. There's a common thread in the country because of slavery, but we really are different. We're as different as Irishmen are from Frenchmen, believe it or not. So how do I relate to you and how do I relate to him? And then the final crisis where the hope seems to be finally blooming through is after I've gone through that, what kind of contribution can I make to this wonderful land? It's not the best, but it's probably the best one around. What kind of contribution can I make? What kind of contribution can I make here that when I leave, what I am and what I do speaks to you louder than any rhetoric you hear from the States? So the hope is, this is hopeful. This is great.
Bill, thank you. Joan and then Bill.
I'm not quite sure what mine is, but I'm thinking back to what Merlin said last night about dragons and our need to create dragons when it's unknown. But we in the whole world, but particularly in the U.S., got rid of one dragon this year because the Soviets are not the threat they once were. But can we as human beings learn to live without dragons? And that's, I just have been pondering that. Do we have to create new ones when we get rid of old ones, or can we learn to look people, you know, other creatures in the eye and not have to be dragons, humans to one another?
Challenge nicely put.
We're in the process of creating one now, which started the Japanese or the Asian.
Yes.
That's the latest dragon. That's the first you discover. Let's hate them because they're buying everything. You know, they own the country. And we forget the equation of buying. If someone buys, someone has to sell.
Basic economics lesson. Bill?
I want to tell a quick Frank and Cecile story. And I believe I have a point, which is hopeful out of that. I had an idea, and this was a long time ago, in the middle of the 60s, and I heard you make a comment, and we have discussed, Jody, you and I are recovering 68s or whatever, in recovery, whatever we are, aren't we? But I was going to school in Atlanta University, and at that time there were, it's a graduate school program in the mid-60s, and there were 30 of us that were white, 900 black students. It's a black university. And I later learned we had the audacity to force our way in. What I thought, I think, was that we were kind of condescending and going down and going to do wonderful things and do marches and help and do all this kind of stuff. And it wasn't all bad. You know, I think some of us I know learned a lot and did some things, and some of it maybe in spite of, or to go back to your comment, condescendingly, and maybe we accidentally did some good things, and maybe we didn't, I don't know for sure. But Tessiel was a woman that was getting her third master's degree, and just an incredibly large, bright black woman that I had a lot of respect for, and had not bothered to get a doctorate in anything because she didn't want to fool around with that stuff. She talked about integration. She says, "Is those fools?" She says, "I go in and I go up to the courthouse, and when I want to eat lunch there, I eat lunch. I've integrated that place 10 years ago. And one of those white boys is never going to stop me." And she, you know, say things like that. But what was interesting to me, and I had some real pain around this and some real confusion, is that she could like Frank and she couldn't like me. And what, and that really confused me for a while. And see, Frank was a white Southern Baptist minister who was classically redneck and racist and open and ugly. And she says, "I understand him and I don't understand you." He says, "I don't know what you're doing down here." He says, "I know what he's all about and I don't know what you're all about. And in a weird kind of way, I trust him and I don't trust you." And I really had to do some thinking. You know, I'd get hurt and I'd get angry and I'd get upset. And she'd say, "Well, you know, you're going to leave. But Frank's going to be here, and I don't know what to do with him. And I'll bring him around, but I don't know about you." So I just had to do a whole, and the funny kind of thing I learned about that, which you may say, "Boy, that's a quantum leap that you made," is that what I can work on is learning as much as I can about me, but the only experience I can give you is my experience, and I can't turn to a black person and say, "Tell me what black experience is," because I don't think they can do it. They can tell me what their experience is, but they can't tell me what black experience is any more than I can tell you what white experience is. I can tell you what Bill Lennon's experience is, but that's about as far as I can go. And I want to try to do that as good as I can, but to make someone a spokesperson for all of this, I don't know how that fits, but that's what one of the things, and Tessie would probably get a kick, she'd probably say, "You finally caught on." Mm-hmm. You know, so anyway.
Certainly one of the ways in which racism constantly works, right, in this country is that the white community is constantly designating black spokespeople, right, to tell us about. That's right. Peter?
A couple of things that, you know, flying out this side of the room, hearing Bill's comment about St. Louis and hearing my dad's stories about when he was growing up. My dad and I went to the same high school, and he went there because his parents were servants in a large house, and he and his sister were the only black students in the school. And when he went out for football in his sophomore year, he wanted to be a wide receiver. And went out for a pass on the first day of practice and was tackled by 21 football players. With 11 players on the team, that includes the quarterback who threw the ball. When I went down to St. Louis to visit Fred, there were no more signs. There was no more back of the train, back of the bus. And that is hopeful for me. What's more hopeful in a situation where you don't have those signs anymore and you don't know who's going to leave, who's going to stand with you or beside you or behind you or in front of you to block the door, you can have to guess or find out after they've already done it, is that as I talk in churches and listen to people, the constant theme that I hear in the black community at any rate is we've got to stop waiting for white folks to give us. We've got to start making ourselves. And that's been the strength of the leaders of every people, you know. But there has been lingering, I think, from the Reconstruction, the idea that old Uncle Sam is going to fix it. And but the progress that has really been made by people who have worked and worked and worked the system, worked through the courts, worked through the graduate schools. still today, the black universities and colleges produce most of the PhDs, most of the doctors, most of the black PhDs, most of the black doctors and lawyers in the country. So in spite of the fact that some of us are getting into and even some of us are getting out of places like Harvard, the University of Chicago, and Yale, and Stanford, and so on, most of our leaders are coming out of the community and out of the institutions that we own and operate. And the leaders, black folk, people of color in general in the church, in the ELCA of us, are making statements of we are going to take charge of our theological education for our students, people from our communities, rather than continuing to sending students off to Chicago, Philadelphia, where they get exposed to one student, or one black faculty member, or one Asian faculty member, one Hispanic faculty member in their entire 4 years of theological education. And that, I'm really excited about that.
Hopefully the rest of everybody else in the United States can begin to share your excitement about the return to and growth of African-American controlled institutions, which I think is in fact happening in lots of realms. I don't know quite what that bell was for.
Compline.
Let me, I don't know where this hour went, but let's close it with one more listen to Galatians, okay? One more listen to one of our major sources of hope. Now that faith has come, we are no longer under a custodian, for in Christ Jesus you are all daughters and sons of God through faith.